Thank you, Ken. I was going to say that if you believed Ken's report of what he and I talked about at dinner, I would like to talk to you after dinner about aluminum siding. But I'm afraid I can now say that if you believe any of that introduction, I'd be glad to talk to you about aluminum siding. I have been looking at your program, and I am impressed. Any society that can get through a program billed as constitutional government, the design, the reality, the prospect, in one day, is an intellectual force to be reckoned with. Your list of speakers, I think, can only be compared with the 1927 Yankees. When I read it and realized I was leading off, I was tempted to bunt just to get on base. Well, the title of my talk is The Crisis in Constitutional Theory, Back to the Future. And anybody who uses the word crisis after a cocktail hour and a dinner ought to be prepared to prove that there is one before he undertakes to rescue you from it. There are few things more annoying than being rescued gratuitously. The crisis of which I speak is that constitutional theory, and hence the future of constitutional law, appear to be at a tipping point. The American ideal of democracy lives in constant tension with the American ideal of judicial review under the Constitution. And that tension arises from what has been called the Madisonian dilemma. The Constitution creates a Madisonian system, which is to say one that allows majorities to govern wide and important areas of life simply because they are majorities, but which also holds that individuals have some freedoms that must be exempt from majority control. The dilemma is that neither the majority nor the minority can be trusted to define the proper spheres of democratic authority and individual liberty. To trust the one, the majority, is to court tyranny by the majority. To trust the other is to ensure tyranny by the minority. Now, it's come to be thought that the resolution of this dilemma is primarily the function of the judiciary and ultimately and most especially of the Supreme Court. That is an awesome responsibility. And judges require a strong theory of how to go about discharging it. In Alexander Bickel's words, judges must achieve a rigorous general accord between judicial supremacy and democratic theory so that the boundaries of the one can be described with some precision in terms of the other. Have we achieved that accord? Most certainly not. Instead, we have lost what we had. Though occasionally violated in practice, in the last century and for half of this century, it was unquestioned dogma that judges were to interpret the Constitution according to the intentions of the men who ratified it. When Joseph Story discussed the constitutional role of the courts, he stated as self-evident, there being no opposing theory, that the first and fundamental rule in the interpretation of all instruments is to construe them according to the sense of the terms and the intention of the parties. We know now from reading their opinions that many of today's judges do not think themselves bound by original intent, and now we have judges saying so openly in speeches and in law review articles. And they say it to the apparent approbation of the press and certainly of most law professors. The professors are quite explicit that the intentions of the founders are ultimately irrelevant. You will have difficulty, I think, naming even one full-time professor in a major law school who writes in favor of original intent. There were once five professors who did, but this administration has put them all on federal courts. That is why I often say that while my colleagues at Yale do not like much else about Ronald Reagan, they regard him as a great reformer of legal education. Well, the non-originalists, or the non-interpretivists, I use the terms interchangeably, now dominate constitutional debate. And it's well to understand them. for they attempt to justify what some courts are in fact doing. The theorists contend that the judges must create new rights by pursuing moral philosophy or by sensing the morality of our society, which oddly enough seems to be the morality of Cambridge and New Haven, or reading the words of the Constitution for the meaning they have to us rather than the meaning they had to the founders. How can that conceivably be justified? Their answer comes in two parts. The first is one of relative institutional capacities. Courts are simply better than legislatures in dealing with principles of long-run importance as opposed to immediate expediency. Alex Bickel said, "Courts have certain capacities for dealing with matters of principle that legislatures and executives do not possess. Judges have, or they should have, the leisure." There, I always pause and my eyes grow a little wet when I read that part. "Judges have or should have the leisure, the training, and the insulation to follow the ways of the scholar in pursuing the ends of government." Professors apparently have very romantic notions about judges' lives. But were we to assume that courts have superior capacities for dealing with matters of principle, it does not follow that courts have the right to impose more principle upon us than our elected representatives give us. Governmental decisions always involve a mix of or a trade-off between principle and expediency. By placing decisions in the legislature, the Constitution holds that the mix or trade-off we are entitled to is what the legislature provides. Courts have no mandate to impose a different mix merely because they would arrive at a trade-off that weighed principle more heavily. The second step in the argument is that the court's commands are not really final and hence not undemocratic, or at least not fatally so. Now, it is true that an outraged people can, if it persists, eventually overturn a Supreme Court decision. Given the number of decisions to be scrutinized, however, the political process would exist in a state of permanent convulsion. As we know from history, it may take decades to accomplish the reversal of a single decision. In the meantime, the American public must live with it. The theory assumes, as one of my clerks put it, that in the long run, none of us will be dead. Well, what is the point of all of this scholarship? And I use the word generously. What is the point of this scholarship devoted to replacing text and history with moral philosophy in constitutional adjudication? If you look at the new rights these theorists would create, rights that lead to a society far more egalitarian, far more socially permissive, and morally relativistic than the one we have, or any that the American electorate wants, the answer is clear. John B. MacArthur puts it this way: non-interpretivists are eager to discard written systems of law, including that based on the Constitution, because written law is a barrier between law and politics. If the judicial process can be reduced to political choice, then the non-interpretivist views will be heard along with other views. When text-based methodologies are rejected, the Constitution, formerly the trump card in the political debate, can be excluded from discussion. And at this point, we got to note that if once this begins to happen to the Constitution, it does not stay with the Constitution. That's my topic for tonight. But the fact is, we have now politicized the reading of statutes in a very significant extent. But why this desperation to abandon the historical Constitution? Because the political values of the non-originalist professors are far different, not only from the values of the Constitution, but from those of the American people. The trick is to appropriate the veneration we feel for and the obedience we give to the actual Constitution for non-originalist political results. As Herbert Schlossberg said, the intellectual class has found a vehicle for giving its values the force of law without bothering to take over the political authority of the state. Judges who behave as the non-originalists wish upset the Madisonian balance and impose the tyranny of the minority. Well, why should we care about what that lowing herd of independent thinkers, the legal academics, think and write in journals that, by and large, only they read? Because, as the very existence of this society and of this program shows, we believe that ideas have consequences. The teaching of non-originalism in the law schools means that generations of law students, many of whom will be coming onto the federal bench in the years ahead, have been trained to believe that judges may, indeed should, remake the Constitution. What used to be a shameful secret is now just beginning to be admitted and may one day be universally and proudly avowed as the judge's duty. 40 years ago, no one could have imagined the extent to which in area after area, judges would claim ultimate power over our lives. If the non-originalist teaching has its intended results, 40 years on, the nation may be governed by judges to a degree that is unimaginable today. This debate between originalism and non-originalism, long hidden in the academic world, is now going public. And for that, we must thank Justice Brennan and Attorney General Meese, who have turned the question of original intention into one of national discussion. Unfortunately, that discussion is too often guided by that most venerable maxim of constitutional analysis, and here you must bear with me, magnopere interest cuius bovem confossum esse, or it makes a big difference whose ox is gored. If you don't like the translation, you can see my clerk. If you don't like the pronunciation, you can talk to me. But it is that way. That is the way the public discussion goes. Which side are you on? And it's essential that we keep bringing the debate back to the basic issue. And the central question in constitutional theory is the legitimacy of power. A judge is unelected, unaccountable, and unrepresentative, I'm happy to say. But he has no source of legitimate power other than law. That means that any intelligible and legitimate theory of constitutional adjudication must rest on the idea that the Constitution is law, not moral philosophy, not the values judges and professors hold dear, but law. What does it mean to say that the words in a document are law? One thing it certainly means is that the words constrain judgment. They compel the obedience of judges every bit as much as they compel the obedience of legislators, executives, and citizens. Constitutional guarantees not only have contents, they have contours that set limits. The fact that there are edges to the Constitution's guarantees means that the judge's legitimate authority has limits and that outside the designated areas, democratic institutions govern. Now, there are those, I don't know how familiar you are with the legal academic debate, and I wouldn't urge you to get too deeply into it, but there are those in the academic world who deny that the Constitution is law. A year or two ago, I made the argument I just made at a small conference, and an eminent constitutional theorist at a very major law school said to me, "Your notion that the Constitution is law must rest upon some obscure philosophic principle with which I am not familiar." He was intelligent enough to see that if the Constitution is law, that the non-originalist party is over. And indeed it is. If the Constitution is not law, what authorizes a judge to set at naught the judgment of the representatives of the American people? If the Constitution is not law, why is the judge's authority superior to that of the president, Congress, the armed forces, the departments and the agencies, and that of everyone else in the nation? Why should anybody obey us? No answer exists. The only way the Constitution can constrain judges and be made law is if the document is interpreted according to the intentions of those who ratify it. That is the way judges deal with other forms of law. Any other approach makes the judge the ultimate legislator. Now, the philosophy of original intention has been parodied as meaning that judges may apply a constitutional provision only to circumstances specifically contemplated by the framers. And if you will recall, that is the way Justice Brennan disposed of the philosophy. In so narrow a form, the philosophy is, of course, useless. Since we cannot know how the framers would vote on specific cases today, in a very different world from the one they knew, no intentionalist or originalist of any sophistication employs the narrow version just described. There is a version that is adequate to the task, and Dean John Hart Ely has described it. I like Dean Ely's book and agree with it up to page 7. And this occurs on page 6. He said, what distinguishes interpretivism from its opposite is its insistence that the work of the political branches is to be invalidated only in accord with an inference whose starting point, whose underlying premise is fairly discoverable in the Constitution, that the complete inference will not be found there because the situation is not likely to have been foreseen is generally common ground. In short, all an originalist requires is that the text, the structure, and the history of the Constitution provide him not with a conclusion, but with a premise. That premise states a core value or principle that the framers intended to protect. The intentionalist judge must then supply the minor premise in order to protect the constitutional and freedoms and circumstances the framers could not have foreseen. Courts perform this function all of the time. It's not a esoteric function. They perform it when they apply a statute, a contract, or a will, or indeed a Supreme Court opinion to a situation the framers of those documents could not foresee. Thus, we are usually able to understand the liberties that were intended to be protected. We are able to apply the First Amendment's Free Press Clause to the electronic media, and should do so more thoroughly, and to the changing impact of libel litigation upon all media. We are able to apply the Fourth Amendment's prohibitions on unreasonable search and seizures to electronic surveillance, and we apply the Commerce Clause to state regulations of interstate trucking. Does this version of intentionalism mean that judges will invariably decide cases the way the framers would have if they were here today? Of course not. But many cases will be decided that way, and at the very least, judges will confine themselves to the principles that the framers put in the Constitution. Entire ranges of problems will be placed off limits to judges, thus preserving democracy in those areas where the founders intended it. That is better than any non-intentionalist theory can do. If it's not good enough, then judicial review under the Constitution cannot be legitimate. I think it's good enough. Well, what are the chances of restoring legitimacy to constitutional theory? I happen to think they are excellent. My confidence is largely due to a law of nature I have recently discovered. This will be handed down in future generations and known and revered as Bork's wave theory of law reform. It'll be known and revered that way, that is, unless some wiseacre develops a quantum theory of law reform. What I have discovered is that courts make law before they have any adequate theory of what they should be doing, and they can't help it. They are forced by the urgencies of litigation to give answers before anyone really knows the questions. Matters are made worse, then, by the legal technique of reasoning by analogy. Only theory can tell you which characteristics of the situation are relevant so that you know which situations are analogous for your purposes. Without a theory, the judge will find false analogies and move the law in harmful directions. That is bound to happen when we thrust judges into fields for which we have no adequate theory beforehand. Now, it's at this point, when the law is moving in directions for reasons that are not theoretically intelligible, it's at this point that the first wave of theorists appears in the law schools. They come after the courts, and it is their function to shoot the wounded and make matters worse. They start from the deformed notions the judges have created, and they extrapolate them. So a rich, erudite, and mindless literature grows up. The courts then begin to adopt the extrapolations, and the future of the law begins to look extremely bleak. But eventually, to some people, the fact that the law and its theorists make little sense begins to become apparent. The result is not only meetings of the Philadelphia Society and good dinners, but a second wave of theory. The second wave theorists return to first principles. They ask what the purpose of the law is, what legitimates the court's behavior, and they begin to construct better theories of how courts should decide cases. Since the second wave arguments are much better, they slowly come to dominate the intellectual world, and the nude ideas eventually percolate through to the courts, and the law is once more on the road to respectability. These reflections are prompted by the history of antitrust law, which in its use of highly general provisions and its open texture resembles much of the Constitution. At the beginning, courts were forced to decide cases for which neither they nor the economics profession were prepared. Law that in retrospect looks very odd indeed began to grow up. Law that was based on an inadequate understanding of the limits to the judge's role and what can only be described as folk economics. Judicial economics is to economics as judicial writing is to a sonnet. It was at this stage that the first wave of antitrust theorists hit. They wrote books and articles about the political and social values that should influence antitrust judges. They wrote books and articles about barriers to entry, leveraging market power from one market to another, vertical foreclosure, oligopoly behavior, market failure, and much more, almost all of it arrant nonsense. But in addition to achieving tenure and consulting fees, these theorists encouraged the courts to even greater policy fiascos. The law came to suppress as much competition as it preserved. Then the second wave began to gather. This is not the time to tell the story of what has been called the Chicago School of Antitrust. I need to say only that a thoughtful and intensely rigorous economist, of whom you have probably never heard because he never wrote, Aaron Director, was invited into Edward Levy's antitrust course. He began to question, and he began to train a few interested students to question the shibboleths of antitrust. And that was the beginning of antitrust reform and moreover, the beginning of the law and economics movement. When I first started at Yale, I really thought the situation of the law was hopeless, that the intellectual content of antitrust was corrupt beyond redemption, and would be kept that way by political forces hostile to the free market. That accounts for the tone of much of my early writing, which, to say the least of it, was sarcastic and confrontational. I thought if you couldn't win, at least you could cause pain on the way out. The fact is, I simply underestimated the power of ideas. Now, that's a very natural error for a professor. If you sit in enough faculty meetings, you are very likely to underestimate the power of thought. But the second wave of director's students started, grew, and achieved a theory of the goals of antitrust based on separation of powers concepts, and a new, much more plausible view of business behavior and the law's proper role in the market. Scholarship was gradually transformed, and so widely has its influence spread that it became possible for people like Bill Baxter, Jim Miller, and Dan Oliver to be appointed and to head the Antitrust Division and the Federal Trade Commission and to survive politically in a way that would have been impossible even 10 years ago. The battles aren't over yet, and I am far from claiming that the economic phenomena of the market are fully understood. But matters are immeasurably improved, and antitrust has been recaptured for a free market rather than an interventionist, statist philosophy. I suggest to you that we're seeing the beginning of the second wave in constitutional theory. The courts addressed what they regarded as social problems after World War II and often did so without regard to any recognizable theory of constitutional interpretation. A tradition of looking to original intention was shattered. Constitutional theorists from the academies, in sympathy with the courts politically, began to construct theories to justify what was happening. So was non-originalism born. That wave has become a tsunami, and its intellectual and moral excesses are breathtaking. Like the first wave theorists of antitrust, these first wave theorists of constitutional law exhort the courts to unprecedented imperialistic adventures. But the second wave is rising. When I first wrote on original intent in 1971 in the article Ken referred to, one of my colleagues told a young visiting professor not to bother with it at all because the position was utterly passé. And so indeed it was. And so indeed it is. But I think it's more than passé. I think it is both passé and the future as well. On that side of the issue, there are now, to name but a few, Judges Ralph Winter and Frank Easterbrook, Professor Henry Monahan, and a former professor, and I always have to mention him because I love his title, Chief Justice of the High Court of American Samoa, Grover Reese. There are many more younger people, often associated with the Federalist Society, who are of that philosophy and who plan to go into law teaching. It may take 10 years, it may take 20 years for the second wave to crest, but crest it will, and it will sweep the elegant, erudite, pretentious, and toxic detritus of non-originalism out to sea. The struggle for the possession of antitrust was crucial because of the educational effect of antitrust. Antitrust's ideas and symbolism go to the heart of capitalist free market ideology. The intellectual struggle for possession of the ideas and symbolism of the Constitution is equally or more crucial. For constitutional theory goes to the heart of America, the American ideology of a democratic order with individual freedom. We have come a long way into scholarly intellectual corruption and judicial imperialism. We have come a long way from the founder's vision of a Madisonian system. But I think we are going back to the future. Constitutional theory will return to Story's assumptions about original intent. But now we go back with a far more sophisticated and hence a stronger and more durable philosophy. That is the one and the only blessing for which must thank our friends, the non-originalists. And I thank you.